First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this workshop. Today I'm going to report on work that I've done in close collaboration with Jürgen Berges and Finnish Sexy, so credits also go to them, of course, the big shares for this work. I'm going to talk about investigations, numerical investigations that we have done on the time evolution of lattice gauge theory and in the classical limit. Okay, and you can also consider our recent paper for further reference if you want. Okay, before I go into the actual talk itself, I will give an outline of how the talk is structured. First of all, I will give a brief, very brief recapitulation of the physics, physical questions that we're interested in to study. Then I will outline our approach and why we think it's good and the limits that we're interested in and how we implement it numerically. Then I will discuss our numerical results and we'll explain how we try to establish contact to physical questions. And finally, I'll draw some conclusions. So let's start with the recapitulation of the physics. It will be brief, as I said, because it has been discussed today already several times. So one of the main questions that have to be answered in the context of heavy ion collision physics is how it comes that ideal hydrodynamics works so well at describing the transverse flow for low momenta, assuming that the evolution of the hydrodynamic equations starts at early times about one Fermi over C. As it has been suggested by Arnold and several collaborators, it's not really a thermal equilibrium that you need to apply hydro, but rather an isotropization. So we have to find out how the system reaches an almost isotropic state very quickly. And it has also been suggested in this reference that plasma instabilities should be the mechanism driving the system towards an isotropic state. So plasma instabilities are the center of interest in tackling these questions. Numerically, there have been different kinds of approaches how to study them. First of all, there is a large group of people who have, for example, Dries Bödeker right now, follows the line to study soft classical gauge fields in the presence of hard classical particles coupled by the Mills equations. And what we do, and which has also been done by Romaschka and Venugopalan in a different setup, is to study the time evolution of purely classical fields. So, and I'm going to, this is what I'm going to talk about today as well. So, let me now explain our setup. We can consider the classical statistical limit of the SU2 gauge theory. Okay, when I say statistical, it's because we have some initial density matrix. We're interested in the time evolution of some initial density matrix with time. And this is where the statistics comes into play. It's classical because we use classical equations of motions to carry out this time evolution. Furthermore, our approach is such that we use a static geometry. That is, we neglect the expansion. We use lattice discretization of the gauge fields, and we put in anisotropic initial conditions because, as has also been explained today several times, this is what we expect to be the situation after heavy ion collision. The classical approximation, you can show formally that it should be a very reliable approximation at early times, provided that the occupation numbers are high, or that there are high occupation numbers. You can also, it has also been checked by several groups that in scalar theories, this approximation provides a very good description at early times. So we think that it's also a good description in our context. Okay, so let me now discuss the implementation that we follow. First of all, as I mentioned, we discuss, we discretize our system in terms of on a lattice. And therefore, we introduce link variables and packet variables. Then we obtain our the dynamics from a Wilson action. I should emphasize it's in Minkowski space since we're interested in real-time evolution. So you might notice this relative minus sign between the kinetic and potential term. And from this Wilson action, we then derive equations of motions by varying it with respect to the spatial link variables. The variation with respect to temporal link variables yields Gauss law, which is a constraint. Furthermore, we do our treatment entirely in temporal axial gauge, which means that the zero component of the gauge field is identical to zero all the time. And we set the coupling constants, which appear here, to one, both of them. For the classical dynamics, this poses no restriction because the classical the coupling can be scaled out of the classical equations of motion. Okay. So now that I've explained to you how we do our time evolution, I should discuss the initial conditions that we put in and then evolve in time. Consider that we suppose we want to, in this classical statistical formalism, that we want to compute some observable as a function of time, for example, this correlator of two A fields. Then what we have to do is that we take a sample initial conditions from our initial density matrix, which is encoded by this probability function of P of A of T naught and its time derivative, indicated by this dot. And we then evolve these samples taken from the generated from the initial distribution in time using the classical equations of motion. So what we have to do is sample, evolve in time, and then average, which is assuming that this measure is normalized in the proper way. Now we have to put in some specific initial conditions. And what we do here is that we formulate this in the momentum space. We provide, we initialize the fields according to this distribution. What is characteristic about it is that, first of all spatial and color components are independent Gaussians, independent Gaussian random numbers. What is now the crucial thing is that we choose the transverse width, indicated by or denoted by delta x, as far bigger than the longitudinal width, which gives us anisotropic initial conditions, which we want to have in order to draw some conclusions or have some analogy with the heavy ion collision. So we choose this delta x much bigger than delta z. And actually, we choose delta z so small that the distribution is effectively delta-like on the lattice. Moreover, we set the initial time derivative of A, which is in temporal axis gauge, the E field, or exactly minus the E field. We set it to zero in the very beginning, so it's like a delta of A dot term. This we do because it's a convenient way to ensure that Gauss constraint is fulfilled at zero time, and the equations of motions keep the Gauss constraint fulfilled up to numerical rounding errors. Yes? This one. On the lattice? On the lattice we have something like a strict delta function of the z, yes? We choose this very small. Yes, the AZ is not zero, of course, yeah. Okay. So I haven't discussed these parameters. So there's one free parameter still in our initial conditions, which is this overall amplitude C. And this we trade for the energy density. We require that the average energy density have some constant value, and then we adjust the C such that our initial conditions yield just this energy density up to some tolerance which we prescribe. Okay. So now that I've discussed our setup, I would like to present you some numerical results. First of all, consider this. Actually, before you consider the plot, let me explain to you in detail what we have plotted. So the observer we are first of all interested in is the stress energy momentum tensor. More precisely, it's ZZ component or 3-3 component. What you see here is some gauge invariant expression for this stress energy tensor. And when you want to think in terms of analogy to classical electrodynamics, you can this is like an electric and this is like a magnetic contribution. We compute this stress energy momentum tensor as a function of x at all times, t, and we then Fourier transform it with respect to the spatial variable x and get the momentum space t sub 3 t of time and momentum. And then we can plot this for what we've plotted in here is that we've taken this Fourier transform as a function of time for various momenta, and we've plotted the ratio of this Fourier transform normalized by its value at zero time, such that all quantities are one in the very beginning. And what we then see is that on the single log clock, plot, we see an exponential growth. Yeah, and well, so this is the first observation. Yeah, we see some exponential growth. We have put in anisotropic initial conditions and classical equations of motion, and we find exponential growth. Yeah, observation. Now, let me explain to you another quantity which is appears in this plot. That is this anisotropy measure psi, which I have defined here. It's basically the transverse momentum weighted with the gauge foot amplitude divided by the longitudinal momentum, again, weighted with the gauge foot amplitude. So it provides a measure, and then we take the logarithm. So it provides a measure of anisotropy. In an isotropic situation, this ratio is 1, and so the psi is 0. And so these values of psi, which are indicated above the plot, provide a measure for the anisotropy during the course of the simulation. And as you can see, since it's a log up to about this time, the field configurations are still highly anisotropic. So let's now discuss in further details what we can discern in this plot. When we consider the, first of all, as I said, we have exponential growth in some of these modes. When we consider the low momenta, so we have different momenta here. This is the lowest, the slightly higher one, intermediate one, and even higher momentum. If we consider the time evolution, we see that the low momenta start, or low momentum modes start to grow exponentially from the very beginning. Yeah, this feature we've dubbed primary instability. Yeah, the growth occurring from the very beginning of the simulation. When we, at later times, momenta or modes with slightly higher momenta either accelerate when they have been growing with a smaller rate before, or they, if they haven't grown, they start to grow very quickly at some intermediate time here. And this phenomenon we've dubbed secondary instabilities. I should make some more remarks here. First of all, this situation is somewhat reminiscent of what has been found in scalar field theories, in parametric resonance and scalar field theories. There are some differences, though, but I will not go into details here. And, No, I think it's not related to the cutoff. We have checked for cutoff dependencies, and it's stable when you change the cutoff. So, provided it's small enough for that expectation. So I think it's not. Yeah. So and now what we would like to know, or well, we would like to relate these findings to physics, of course, at the end of the day. And so we would like to know what are the timescales here on the x-axis. Well, I haven't explained yet. The time is taken in units of the energy density, or appropriate powers of the energy density. We have fixed the average energy density to some constant value on the lattice, and we measure the time in units of epsilon to the minus 4. So now one has to make, if one wants to make contact to the real world, one has to put in some value for the energy density. And if one, for example, browses the literature and looks for values for epsilon, one finds typically something like in the range, say, 10 to 30 GeV per Fermi cubed. And if one then converts these times, one sees that these, one finds that these are very long, like 10 or 20, order 10 to 20 Fermi, only from start of the simulation to the saturation. However, we should not take the zero of our, the t equals zero point of our simulation as a physical, as something physical, because as we see from this anisotropy measure, the field configuration is still highly anisotropic till, well, about this time approximately. So if you just require that the initial conditions be anisotropic, we can equally well say the field configuration at hour t equals 100 could be something like a physical initial condition, and therefore we shouldn't take these, this t equals 0 point too literal. Therefore, we should rather consider the time differences as something physical, and in turn, this means that we should study the growth rates. Yeah? And I will do that on one of the next slides. Okay. So what is plotted here? As I said, I want to study the growth rates. This is what we have here. What is plotted here is the growth rate, again, in units of epsilon to the 1 over 4. Plotted versus the z component of the momentum. Oh, I forgot to mention that on the last slide, these momenta these modes, oh, sorry, this is in the wrong direction. And these modes, they're all parallel to the z-axis, which is the which is singled out by our initial conditions as the axis of anisotropy. And this is the modulus of the momentum along the z-axis. Okay, so this is again, okay, and this modulus of momentum appears here again. So we have the growth rate as a function of momentum modulus along the z-axis. Then what we see here is that we have the primary growth rates with rather low compared to the other ones. Here in the lower left corner, for with this narrow band of modes exhibiting primary growth, and then we have a broad range of modes exhibiting the secondary growth. And the secondary growth rates are typically higher by a factor of, say, 2 to 4 than these primary growth rates. Okay, so now when we again want to have some numbers on the to get some numbers and some idea what this converts to in the real world, let's again convert these numbers to physical ones. If we assume some energy density at Rig of 30 GeV per Fermi cubed at the time when the gluons are freed from the nuclei, we see that the inverse primary growth rate, or the maximum, or I should say the inverse of the maximum growth rate, primary growth rate, is something like 1 Fermi over C. The secondary rate translates into a shorter, even shorter time, factor of 3 approximately. And in order to get some feeling how this changes when one puts in another energy density, I've also quoted a value for probably too low an energy density, 1 GeV per Fermi cube. And they would find something like 2.6 Fermi over C as the time scale associated with the fastest primary growth here. Yep. So there's a fourth root here, so the dependence on the energy density you put in is rather mild. You may ask, how much of an energy density do we have to put in order to achieve something like, say, 0.1 Fermi over C, so gain a factor of 10 or so. And this, if you do the algebra, you find that this is related to a ridiculously high energy density of 200 to 300 TeV per Fermi cube, which is certainly too high. So, okay. Yeah, so what does this tell us? And this I've already mentioned. What can we say at this point? Okay, we find growth rates which are of approximately the right order of magnitude, but they are probably still a bit slow because if you imagine that the instability should have some impact on the physical situation, we would expect that we need, say, several e-foldings, like, say, 4 to 10 or so, to achieve some orders of magnitude growth. And therefore, the timescales associated with that are still a bit high. However, for example, these here could look more realistic. On the other hand, as I said, the effect of the secondaries depends somewhat on what the initial conditions are, or what the physical initial conditions are. So I can't make too strong a statement about the role of these secondaries. Okay, now let me show you something else that we've found. At the end of the day, we want to have some isotropic state, at least approximately isotropic state at the end of the time evolution. So we should check how different momentum sectors of this system evolve for this time and if they become isotropic. So in order to monitor this, we have computed the following ratio. We have again taken the Fourier transform as of the stress energy tensor, of the ZZ component of the stress energy tensor as a function of time and longitudinal momentum. And then we've also computed the Fourier transform of the transverse components of the stress energy tensor, say XX and YY component, and we've evaluated them at transverse momenta. And we've chosen these momenta such that they, this one is aligned along the z-axis and this one in the transverse plane. And we've chosen their absolute values such that they're equal. Yeah? And in an isotropic situation, this ratio should be 1. Yeah? So if we, failure of this ratio to be 1 gives us a measure of how far the, to what extent the field configurations are isotropized at this momenta. Okay, so we can now compute these ratios and plot them versus time, again measured in appropriate units of the energy density. And so we've done this here for three different momenta, yeah, small one, intermediate one, yeah, and even higher momentum. And what we then find is that the low momentum modes, they indeed make it to some value close to one or even one at slightly later times. So we can say that there's something like the field configuration isotropizes for this momentum range. Higher momenta, well, they stay highly anisotropic during a long time, then grow and come closer to isotropy, but still they do not make it. There's still a big factor between this mode is still far away from isotropy at this time, it's a factor of 10 or so. And you may ask, well, how long does it take for the UV modes to reach an isotropic state? What you find then that it takes asymptotically long. And since we are in a classical approximation, we cannot trust the time evolution at too late a time. And therefore, in our approach, we can say that these modes do not become isotropic. So the UV does not become isotropic. Okay, so to summarize, we see that the instabilities indeed have the effect to bring the system towards an isotropic state. In the IAR regime, we see that these ratios become one, so the system becomes isotropic on these length scales. To relate this again to physical units, when you convert this, or when you say as a criterion, we want to have something like a ratio of 0.5 or 0.6 here at some certain time, you can deduce some value of about the GV. This is meant when I say IR, I mean P less than about the GV. Yeah, so this region, regime becomes isotropic. And the higher modes, they do not become isotropic during the course of our simulations. And, do not see them become isotropic. And, we cannot make any further statements when they should become isotropic within our approach. And, since this is the IR, which isotropizes first, we have dubbed this bottom-up isotropization in analogy to the celebrated bottom-up thermalization. Okay. So, I think I've lost time for this. We wondered what is the mechanism behind the secondaries, these secondary instabilities. You remember these accelerated growth at intermediate times. And since there was something similar in parametric resonance, where one could identify contributions of certain diagrams to the PI self-energy as cause for this, we have tried to do some similar evaluation of our data to check if certain, if we can identify the diagrammatic contributions giving rise to the secondary instabilities. So what we've done is that we've measured this correlation function f as a function of displacement and some real Fourier transformed it and time, and that we've computed numerically these diagrams, this one loop, one gluon loop, and the setting sum diagram from these numerically measured correlation functions at equal time. And what we're interested then is is the contribution of these diagrams to the correlation function, or can we numerically relate to? Okay, so when if you do this analysis, maybe have a look at the diagrams first. We see is that what we see here is this equal time correlation function for a momentum mode exhibiting such a secondary instability. It's again normalized to one in the beginning. So we see the exponential growth here again showing up in a very similar way as in the stress energy tensor. And then we've evaluated these diagrams using the perturbative indices and the full classical propagator, which is this correlation function, and computed this ratio. And what you see then is that the time when the secondary growth sets in is correlated with the time when these diagrams become of order one here or reach their final value. So, okay, we see that when these diagrams become numerically large, that this corresponds to the time when the secondary set in. Of course, you can say, there may be cancellations between diagrams and so on, so it's not which is true. So it's not a strict proof, but it gives some numerical indication that the mechanism behind this secondary instabilities is, are the self-interactions of the gauge field, or certain self-interactions of the gauge field. Finally, we have also studied the time resolution of spatial Wilson loops, and we have tried to check if we can see the isotopization process in terms of the Wilson loop. And in order to do that, we have computed Wilson loops which are purely transverse, so they are solely in the x and y plane. Remember, the z direction was our anisotropic direction. And we've also computed Wilson loops which have one which are elongated along one side in the longitudinal direction, these WL loops. And then we can monitor the time evolution of these loops. First of all, in the beginning here, or at early times, you see that there's there seems to be quite a good approximation in area law for the transverse loops, while for the longitudinal ones, there's certainly no area law. If we then study the time evolution, you see that, something happens. And finally, at the time, this is about the time when the instabilities have saturated, we see that there's an area law in both directions, and that the string tension, or the slope, you can deduce from these plots, becomes more and more, and that it converges towards each other. So we see some isotropization on the level of the Wilson loops as well. Okay, and if you do the numerics, you find that this string tension, which you can deduce from here, converts to some non-zero value, which is also expected for thermal equilibrium, for quite a time, actually, early 80s, I think. Okay. Yeah. So this brings me to the conclusion. So we have studied the time evolution of classical gauge fields using the classical statistical approximation. What we found is first of all, we see exponential growth in several modes of the field, so we see some instabilities, and estimating their growth rates in physical units, we see that the time scales associated with the growth are of order one Fermi over C, which is, close to what we have, but maybe still a bit small. And we also see that the infrared sector of our system becomes isotropic, and by infrared I mean momenta less or similar of order 1 GeV. The GeV sector remains anisotropic till late times, and we cannot say much more because it's in the classical approximation. We cannot go to arbitrarily large times. The question which remains open is that, what can you do with this? Is this sufficient to explain the applicability of hydrodynamics? Well, that I cannot really answer. Okay. And also, what will be important for future work is certainly to see what happens in the UV, and therefore certainly has to take into account quantum corrections as well, and in order to see later time evolution. Okay, so that's it. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, thanks for the nice talk. Questions or comments?
Yes. Parametric resonance.
Yes. And the question I'm going to ask you is that in this case related to the UV or the main isotropic to the late times, or is it a completely separate issue?
Pardon, sorry.
You said in the conclusion,
yes.
UV is the main isotropic to the late times.
Yes. And isotropic.
I'm asking you, is that the same thing connected with the similarity in the behavior of this problem with the modeling?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I don't really know, sorry.
There is no hypothesis in the sense
I wanted to comment on this question about whether this is enough for ideal hydrodynamics. Ideal hydrodynamics, that's what you really mean by there. Well, isotropization of the momenta is enough to decompose the energy momentum tensor into an ideal fluid form. But that doesn't make it ideal hydrodynamics yet, because you also need an equation of state. That means you need a relationship between the pressure and the energy density. And for that to be unique, you need to know the momentum distribution. You don't need to know whether it's, it's not enough to know that it's isotropic, but you actually need to know the dependence on P squared or on the energy. And so, well, you can argue, could argue that QCD is a system of massless particles. For that, the trace of the energy momentum tensor is always zero, so epsilon must be 3p, irrespective of whether it's exponential or not. But that, the problem with that is that lattice QCD tells you that even in equilibrium, you have deviations from epsilon equals 3p in the interesting region for Rick, which are rather big, so that doesn't save you. So I think in the end, isotropization is not enough for ideal hydrodynamics. You have to have the collisions to keep it in, to actually make the momentum distribution thermal. And if the collisions is not, are not efficient enough to do that, then non-equilibrium, anisotropic collective expansion actually drives you again away from isotropization. So you have to this competition of the instabilities driving towards isotropization, and then the anisotropic collective flow driving you away, that Guy Moore mentioned in his talk. And I think you have to tackle that competition between collisions and exponential growth rates of instabilities in order to get a feeling for what's going to happen really.
Okay, one more.
I wonder if you look at the correlation function of energy momentum tensor, because in principle, I mean, you have a statistical field theory, so by a Kubo formula you can calculate the infrared limits omega equals zero and extract transport coefficient, which may or may not be related to transport coefficient of QCD, but it would be nice to see what happens to this spectral function as the anisotropy involves, so as you have this isotropization.
Okay. Yeah, we should keep in mind that we are in a situation which is very far from equilibrium, and the transport coefficients make, well, they measure how a system responds to deviations or small deviations from equilibrium. So this may, yeah. Yeah.
Of course, transport coefficients, as we usually talk about it, is calculated for thermal equilibrium, but you do have a very slow evolution after the instability saturates. And as we heard also from Guy, it goes towards a power law spectrum, which is actually just, if you want to phrase it this way, a fixed point of your evolution equations. It's a scaling solution. It's non-thermal. It's, in that respect, static, if you like, at least over a certain range of time. And you could think of linearizing around that and extracting also the response to this static solution. So I think there's a way also, in a rather definite way, to talk about transport coefficients close to, or as a response of a deviation to the scaling solutions. Yeah. I think more groups are currently doing it. It's not just us.
You have two scales in the system. One is the energy density, say, fourth root, and the other one is the transverse momentum distribution size. How do they relate in your simulation?
Yeah, what I've actually tried is when you do, in the context of HDL calculations, you have this mass scale M infinity squared, which is an integral over the particle distribution over P, and divided by P. And yeah, what I've tried is to get something like a particle number, which is, of course, has some ambiguities due to the gauge, because of the gauge theory, and to calculate this M infinity from this, and this turns out to be some number times square root of energy density divided by the width, the mass M infinity. And you can, it works numerically quite good to scale the curves on top of each other with the with this using this coefficient or this number, this M infinity. So I think it's the ratio square root u divided by delta x, which is the scale. In the and this in this runs. Okay, the point five. It's about one. Yeah. The runs were all at constant delta x.
So you are constantly talking about isotropization, but probably running the same equation could give answers to questions about thermalization. So how far are you from thermal spectrum? Well, of course, you know that classical field theory is very peculiar when getting close to equilibrium, but maybe for an infrared sector you could say something, especially for the equation of state, how far you are from the final equilibrium one.
That I haven't really checked in detail, so...
Okay, thanks. So we thank the speaker again and continue the talk.